terrified, the boy cried out, "Hog!" But his parents, suspecting another trick, ignored him. So the boy logged on to energyhog.org, played cool games, learned how to rid the cottage of the energy hog, and became a hero to his family. And the moral is, to use energy wisely, log on to energyhog.org. Or, if you cry hog, it better be a hog calling contest.
This public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
I don't know why democracy not cut off like that, but it did. I'm upset I was listening to it. But we need to get some real software here that doesn't do that. Go to democracynow.org to hear it without being interrupted by various things.
You know what I think's going on? I think the station is too beautiful and too comfortable for us, and people are just kind of in like a... They're gliding along. They're not realizing that we still have things to add, to contribute, to build here. And it may look finished, but we're not finished. We have so much history. I know we want to get to some tape archiving that's really important for the station.
Mm-hmm.
There's records everywhere in some sort of organized... shelving system, but it's not complete. We're not there yet. So hopefully other people at the station are just, you know, recuperating from the big move, and we're gonna get another wave of excitement for what's possible, because there's so much music that we're not able to play. There's, you know, attributes of the programming that just aren't quite at everybody's fingertips. And this, the 10 minutes in, all of a sudden Democracy Now! Is, like, cut off. It's just...
Yeah, it's... We're sorry about technical problems.
It's not who we are.
No. And don't blame us. We just walked in. I ran in, actually. Nice day outside.
Yeah, it got sunny. The clouds cleared away, and it's warmed up again.
We're not here to talk about the weather.
It's not brutal. No, there's so many more shallow, vapid things we could address.
Yeah. Like, you know, we're not going to mention the World Cup scorer. We don't want anybody to who hasn't seen the game, United States versus England, to have it spoiled. I've had that happen to me, and I don't want it to happen to anybody else.
But you should,
let's just say it's a good thing. It's a good thing that, you know, these sports are being played. And
by women.
The first time I've ever really cheered my own national team, only because they are so cool. They really are.
Yeah.
I like them a lot.
No, it's fascinating to watch and cool to see competition of that level in, you know, outside the Men's World Cup. I think this is as entertaining, and I think on par, maybe even a little bit more interesting than the men's games. Just really full of action. So if you haven't caught it, catch up, because there's a lot of gameplay out there.
Full of action, but it's also cleaner. It's a cleaner game.
Yeah. Yeah,
there aren't as many egregious tackles and not as much violence, and it's still every bit as exciting. So you don't need those elements to have a good game.
Yeah, it's about scoring those goals, and true. You just don't seem to see as much tripping up and falling and grabbing of injuries. There's a little of that, but it isn't the main part of the show. The real show is passing. And strategy and, you know, some of the plays they make.
And it's not so much about superstardom, although there are some real superstars there, but it doesn't seem to be the driving force. You know, there's no Ronaldo that has, you know, the planet circling around him. It's about the game, and I think they get that more.
And all the players are qualified, equally qualified, and, you know...
Well,
one
not Thailand, they're not. I'm sorry,
right. Well,
13-0. Oh, boy.
The point I was trying to make before I was derailed was that there's no particular player that's a linchpin for a team necessarily. Like, oh, you don't have one or two players, you can't match the gameplay. No, everybody's equally really aggressive and talented players and
the Thailand team
capable.
I definitely would say was equal all the way through, you know. Boy, I feel bad for them. I really do. But these things happen.
They should stick to spelunking and cave diving.
All right, that's not called for. But but you know, there's another big game that took place in the last week, and actually two games. The debates. We watched the debates. 20 candidates. What do you think about having 20 candidates debating, not at the same time, 10 and 10? But do you think that's too many?
I have mixed feelings. I mean, no, I don't have mixed feelings. I don't want to go for the obvious answer. I think that actually it is good because Democrats and Americans, because I'm not going to be partisan here, I think we have a lot to digest and to think about as far as what we want to do with our leadership. And we've tried this. Not everyone has been thrilled with it. I think people who were initially thrilled maybe are less thrilled. And maybe there's people that are content or happier at the outcome. Maybe they're excited for tanks on 4th of July. But the point is, if all goes as planned, we're going to have a leadership change in a little over a year. And, well, we need to be sure about what that change will be. Who is going to take the helm, and what direction are we going to go in? Are we going to do more of this kind of thing? Are we going to, you know, go for a second term for this particular leader? Or are we going to develop kind of some other pathways, some other directions, some other teams to get in there and affect change for on behalf of the American people?
Well, yeah, I think, personally, I love the idea of having this many people participating. I know it's confusing. I know it seems crowded. But this is how you test them out, and you see who's good, who interacts well, who raises points. You start, you know, I think us following the FA Cup and Champions League and Europa League and all that nonsense that we did over years, I think this is where it kind of pays off, because you realize, you know, you start off with a massive number of teams, but you always come down to the good teams in the end. You have to go through the paces, but you get there and you prove yourself. And I think politics shouldn't be any different. It shouldn't just be, you know, the top two or three, you know, the Bidens and whatever else is up there. No, it should be people that you've never heard of before who maybe say something that really sticks with you, that makes you question what you believe in, and maybe makes you give them a second chance, or maybe shines a light on somebody else. That is how you get somewhere, not just by assumptions, by actually playing the game. And that's what they're doing now. And that they're going to be doing it again at the end of this month, two more nights of 10 people each. And I'm fascinated by it all. We went through this. We had fun. We kind of devised their own system and made rankings as we were watching each debate. And our scores weren't – we didn't look at each other's scores as we were doing it, but they weren't that different, right? I think we were pretty similar in our conclusions.
It's true, yeah. The scoring systems were different. Mm-hmm. I think both of us had
– we totally made them up.
Yeah, we had our own kind of style. We had our own columns and categories to check off things per each candidate. But at the end, when we were going through and sort of placing an order and kind of ranking based on interpretations. You know, when you hear something good, you maybe give it a tally or a plus or minus if it's not so good.
Right.
That's basically what both our systems amounted to. I think they were somewhat similar, but
yeah,
close enough.
Yeah, somebody stumbled over a sentence or, you know, their pants fell down or something like that, they got a minus for presentation.
Or they were awkward in a moment.
If they said something that didn't really move us either way, they didn't get anything. And if they got a plus, you know, that's because they said something that resonated. Yeah, that's a good point. Marking that down. And then what I did at the end, I simply had all the minuses cancel out the pluses, and any extra pluses, that gave them a positive score. Any extra minuses, that gave them a negative score. And I just ranked everybody by the total score.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is important to remember, and speaks to your earlier point that this is an opportunity to hear them out. We have, and what I was saying, they have a lot. We have a lot to think about as a country, as parties, and whatever the direction's going to go, whatever we choose. This is a moment where they're not so polished. They
right.
are on stage. They are unscripted overall. I mean, they have maybe talking points and so on, but it's not the point. And the other candidates who are there in the discussion can trip the other of their debaters up mm-hmm. with a line of questioning or a counterpoise to whatever explanation or answer they give. And it's also telling, you know, who's really listening. Even if there are no other people on the stage, who's actually listening and answering the question, because there was a lot of that, too. I think across the board,
right.
both nights, candidates who didn't answer the question. Now, namely, Joe Biden.
But, okay, you're skipping. Don't skip.
We haven't
started the first night yet. We're going to quickly go through the first night, then the second night. Biden,
oh, yeah, I'm on the wrong
second
page.
Night, yeah.
Okay, no,
so
sorry.
Let's not confuse ourselves. But I hear what you're saying as far as actually answering the question. I think so many people didn't do that. They had their own talking points. I'll get to your question, but first let me say a speech, and then I run out of time, and I don't get to answer the question, which is my point in the first place.
Yeah, to me that's equivalent to having been tripped up by someone else, but you're tripping yourself up because you're being evasive.
Yes.
And those are moments that are not, you know, campaign managers can't craft that. Mm-hmm. They can't do damage control, really, except maybe after the fact and as like a post-mortem of how the debate went. But in the moment, they're left to their own devices. They have to come out, either draw on a talking point, be natural, be conversational, be antagonistic, challenge the questioner or the counterpoise or whatever is coming at you. And I think that's when the real person comes through, not just the coiffed, controlled candidate, but the real authentic person that you're going to be voting for. And then, of course, coming away from it, how did people react to it? And that was great. Us having separate systems, sort of a microcosm of two individuals who were, yeah, watching the same thing, but the country and all of us, the world, was watching this whole thing collectively and doing the same thing. So when we compared notes, we had different categories, but we basically looked at where we tallied. Like if I had the same number of tallies, you had the same number of tallies, we considered them ranked and placed them. We had a little bit of order differences with ranking, but I don't know. How do you want to go through this?
Okay, well, who did you like in the first debate? Who finished top for you?
Okay, Castro.
You see, I didn't like Castro. Castro, to me, seemed overly slick. There was something about his expression that made me not want to trust him. It looked like he was kind of looking down on everybody. It didn't work with me. I ranked him number six, actually, on the first night. I gave Elizabeth Warren the top score for that because she always had something to say. She was enthusiastic. She had plans. She was on top of every point. And I just think that she really did a good job.
Yeah, I admit it, and I'll say it again publicly here, that I did surprise myself. I was definitely kind of rooting for Warren a lot and wanted to see what Amy Klobuchar would do, as well as a couple other candidates, specifically de Blasio and, of course, Jay Inslee from my home state.
I ranked Klobuchar last, only because she didn't present herself well. She seemed hesitant. Just didn't really make good points. De Blasio, though, he surprised me. I wasn't expecting him to do well. And I don't know why people criticize him so much. They really do. People on the left and the right, it's really something. I guess, you know, the mayor of New York, you always have to hate the mayor of New York, but wow. He was criticized for jumping in. If he didn't jump in, he would have been criticized for not jumping in. But he really jumped in aggressively, made a lot of points. I think that's what debates should be. There was too much timidity, too many, here's a really important question. You have 5 seconds to answer it. Things like that. I like to see interaction between the candidates, and de Blasio was not hesitant in jumping in and doing that. That's why he made it all the way up to number three for me. I was not expecting that. I was hoping Beto O'Rourke would do well, and he disappointed me. He just didn't seem to have it that night. I've seen him with passion. Didn't seem to have passion, seemed hesitant, looked like he didn't get any sleep the night before, and I put him down at number five. My number two, by the way, was Cory Booker. I think he also did a really good job, second only to Elizabeth Warren. But I think those are the two that shine on the first night, is Warren and Booker.
Yeah, and so Castro was a bit of a surprise. I didn't have the same response to his presentation when he responded, the smarmy, smirky look.
you saw that, right?
Yeah, I know where you're coming from. It was more like a... I felt, and I said this at the time, more of a academic, professorial Obama, aftertaste
of
response.
Obama never had that expression.
Okay, all right.
He was professorial.
Yeah.
I'll give you that.
Yeah,
but,
Obama will come through and
it was
slap me.
It was
but
in a pleasant kind of a way.
Yeah, it was really pleasant. But my point, what I wanted to get to, not Castro, was that yes, I also had Booker as number two. And was really impressed with him. I've been critical of him before on this very show, talking about him being kind of too nice, too kid-friendly, too too quiet and, mm-hmm. and you know, just, well, monotone, not dynamic.
I was worried.
In his delivery.
Yeah.
Because he can be... He can be kind of a low rumble, resounding orator that just kind of goes along, but you're not getting the emphasis. He doesn't convey emphasis when he's going on like a monologue. But in this context, it worked out. There was something about what he was saying specifically with Iran and some of the international stuff. I wrote that down. He did attempt to speak Spanish, which I think across the board people got points for. It was a little bit of a show-off when it started
up. I think at least three candidates spoke several sentences in Spanish, which is great.
Right.
It threw the moderators for a loop, because I don't think anybody understood what they were saying. Well, one moderator did.
Castro, de Blasio, and Booker.
They didn't translate it for the audience at home.
Right.
And, you know, I have no problem with that. I know Fox News people must be going crazy.
Yeah.
But it's good to see. It's refreshing to see people with bigger horizons and are able to speak to more people.
Right, and I think O'Rourke started it too, and that was Booker gave him like the look, like the wide-eyed look, like, oh, we're gonna do that.
Yeah.
So, but Booker did not shy away from that, mm-hmm. and ended up saying a few words in Spanish eventually, and I think in a less awkward way than Beto did, because again, Beto was not doing, he wasn't really sticking out, he wasn't confident.
I don't know what happened to him.
He seemed just exhausted and not in command of his own performance in quite the way I would have expected him. I would have expected him to be doing a little bit more of the de Blasio tact of maybe rebutting or breaking in
had
somewhere.
Had he done that, I think he would have fared so much better. Had he done it de Blasio.
He would have got cheers, too. Mm-hmm. Remember, there's been some critiquing of having an audience there in the particular format. They were told not to cheer, but it was rampant throughout both evenings.
Why have an audience then if you don't expect them to cheer? What's the point of having an audience?
It's true. Yeah. What are they for?
So, you had Castro number one. You had Booker number two. Where did Warren fit in on your rankings?
Oh, yes, indeed. Where was Warren? Well, again, where were the things she's saying, where were they leaping out at me? And I just wasn't hearing... anything particularly concrete, although she did speak about healthcare in ways that that came through to me, and also just her overall attitude of fighting. And she said she'll mm-hmm. fight for the American people.
I believe her.
A good closing. And let's see. Those are. Three. It was Castro, Booker, and then I had Inslee, de Blasio, tied.
Inslee and de Blasio.
Well,
ahead of
they were
Warren?
Tied. They
Have
were
you
tied.
Taken leave of your senses?
I know you were upset at me. I you said that, but she's after. She was fifth.
Number five. That's what you did to Elizabeth Warren. Number five out of ten.
It's not a crime.
And Inslee, I mean, I know he's your governor, but...
Okay, I didn't even write Klobuchar down.
For
so
God's
give me
sake.
A break. Yeah, Inslee, that's... I have my loyalties. It was a tie with de Blasio. I think both of them probably behind Warren. It's probably Castro, Booker, Warren, if I'm being honest. But I was probably... I had a plus for her, and at least just three moments that stuck out that resonated.
You know what
I didn't really comment much more. I didn't write it down.
You know what I think it is? I think you have Warren fatigue. I think you've heard too much Warren.
No. That's a great point, because I realized that when we were coming away from the first evening, I realized that this might be something I would be susceptible to. And by the second night, I definitely found that. I think a lot of people did, especially with Bernie Sanders, because they're like, yeah, Bernie was just Bernie. And I think I'm too familiar with Warren having a plan that's almost becoming a joke, and just too familiar with her advocacy to have anything stand out. I'm just sitting there like, yes, of course. You know, she wasn't bringing anything new to people that were already all things being equal, mm-hmm. loyal to her,
right.
At least to her ideas and to her platform. So yeah, I may have miscalculated that, and again, we didn't use the same rating system.
We
kind of made it up. I had four categories. My four were confidence, authenticity, platform, and look, which is kind of a superficial.
Mine were clarity, strength, passion, and sincerity. So, yeah, I think it was similar enough, but we obviously have our differences. Okay, let's move on to the second night, which was also interesting, but I think we both agreed – that Kamala Harris kicked ass that night.
Yes.
And she was the clear winner.
Yes.
And Biden's ass was clearly kicked down the road, and he was not the winner. Where'd you put Biden?
Out of total?
Yeah. Out of the 10, where'd you put him? I had him at number 4. Okay.
Seventh?
My God.
I had him behind Yang and Swalwell.
Behind who now?
Yang and Swalwell.
Oh, wow. Okay. If I don't remember what they look like, that's a bad thing. Swalwell.
Yeah.
I forget which one he was.
He was the 14-year-old.
Oh, the guy that kept saying, pass the torch?
Yeah.
You know what that meant. He wanted the joint. That's what he was trying to say. Pass the joint.
Yeah.
That's what that means.
Sorry, bro.
No, Harris, number one. I gave Buttigieg number two.
Excuse me.
Well, actually, Buttigieg and Sanders tied for 2 and 3. I thought
I had that
really
as well.
The same thing?
After the adjusted score, the first page I didn't really do the adjusted score.
What's the adjusted score?
Well, you had your tally system. I had tally, minus, and plus. So tally for a moment that I noticed, you know, that something resonated, plus for just overall satisfaction with their performance in any one of the categories or just in general or on a specific topic they bring up, and then minus if, you know, they're just not doing very well, or they come off badly or give a bad answer or choke.
Okay.
Anyway, so the second day I adjusted the score. So I had an initial score of just the tallies, the moments I noticed, and then I adjusted with like the plus or minus, kind of like what you did. I started mimicking a little bit of how you were balancing out the pluses and minuses, although I didn't do that exactly the same.
It's weird because you just find yourself checking off these pluses and minuses, and then at the end you're trying to look at how many you've given to everybody. At the end you add it up, and it's remarkable how you wind up with the candidates that you believe are the best candidates getting the most points.
Yeah.
Just based on the points that you made. It's not like you're trying to make somebody win or that you're charting the progress as you go along.
Well,
it's interesting to see that develop.
And it's about partly the platform that they're using and the setup. Like, they were basically given a question or an opportunity in more or less an equal balance across the nights. But if something didn't speak to you and then they didn't ad lib or rebut or break into something, you weren't going to give them any kind of consideration, and that's the moment that they have. And
right.
the beginning of our conversation, I just was hearing this, and I think it's worth noting, and that is in part because they're not scripted and that they're kind of on their own. They can't be coiffed and handled, more or less, by campaign managers. But as much as the run-up to these events is kind of a crapshoot, you don't know who's ahead, who isn't, these do define our perceptions. Debates really do matter. This is how we narrow the field in these moments.
Absolutely.
Because this is how they do on their feet. What kind of orator? What kind of reaction do we have?
How do they react to attacks? And that's where Biden lost. I found him to be defensive. I found him also to be struggling for words. I don't know if you noticed this, but he was when he was basically spewing out facts, he often would stumble upon certain names of places or people. And I don't see that as a good thing. I see that as a potential stumbling block. Whereas other people were clear and were able to cite certain instances of things and dates or places. And that's important. Presentation does matter. You might be more intelligent, you might be more qualified, but if you can't present yourself well, that's going to be a mark against you, and unfortunately, that hurt Biden.
And
I say unfortunately because I'm not really a big fan of Biden. I think him being the front runner is just it's a safe play for the Democrats, and I'm tired of being safe.
Yeah, and if they're not taking it seriously enough, and they're everything is being done for them, you know, their team's a great team, that kind of hurts them at a certain point. They need to be able to represent themselves and not be have it be handheld all the way to the White House.
Right.
And they if they are not taking it serious enough to realize that this debate, these questions, these opportunities you have with us can make or break your chances. So to that end, you know, if they weren't nervous, they were not taking it serious enough. And those who to channel that energy, I think, came out ahead. So I don't know if you want to do placement or what other candidates I had or any comments.
Who was your last place for the second night?
Oh, God. You know, I'm going to get this.
Go ahead.
I don't know if this is definitely not politically correct, but I had Williamson last, and my one comment is that I thought she was a witch.
Oh, Williamson. Yeah, she was.
I know that
witch
has
in the good side. Witches are good.
I know that has implications.
I know people yeah. do Wicca and things like that. And but she said some really interesting things. She was talking about health and our overall views on things like that. But some of it was way out there about New Zealand and things like that. But you know, you need that. You need that kind of off the road type of journey a little bit to have a conversation. So I'm glad she was there.
Yeah,
she's not going to win. I had her at tied for number 8 with Hickenlooper. My last place was Bennett.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what Bennett looks like, so I'm not sure how much he stood out.
Yeah, I just wrote that he's sleepy and aloof, and he got 3 minuses
for
me.
He made me sleepy, I'll
yeah.
say that, but I still don't remember.
But Williamson did make good points. In fact, he probably was more deserving of last.
You mean she?
She.
Yeah.
No. Bennett was probably more worthy of last. Williamson being better than Bennett. And actually, now that I look at it, Bennett was -3 in the final calculation. Oh, she got -4. But, so, yeah, I didn't like a couple of things she said, but she did raise good points. And I think not having political experience, not being a political creature, she was able to look at the macro of what's going on, like talking about the chemical industry. Those things, if you listen to the show, I say all the time, constantly. I'm tired of hearing myself say them.
Mm-hmm.
It's important. It's important to have people that look at the big, big picture of what is the function of society and economics and how are things interrelated. That's great, but that's not necessarily as detailed a plan as you need to be a leader.
It might get other people to focus on that, and that's why it's good, especially at this level of the debates. So in the end, what I did was, and this is totally random, I just added up all the scores together and simply ranked of the two nights the top 5. And this is what I got, and I'm really kind of surprised by this. Based on performance, attributes, my own patented formula, top 5 candidates, number 1, Warren, number 2, Booker, number 3, Harris, tied for 4 and 5, Buttigieg and Sanders. And I would be thrilled with any of those candidates. And being able to say that, being able to say the top 5, I'm happy with all of them, tells me that system is a pretty good system. I think that it speaks to what I believe in and who I thought did a good job, and it also makes me optimistic about where we're going. Of course, the top ranked candidate right now isn't in that list, but Biden's lead has dropped dramatically, and I think Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren are closing in within something like 5 points. And it's going to be interesting, and the second debate is certainly going to tighten things up some more, I think.
So I'm Hastro. Let's see. I'm sorry, Hastro. Harris Castro.
No, merge them together. That's awesome.
I'm thinking Williamson Stein. That should be the ticket. You know, Jill Stein and Williamson. They could be great candidates. But no. I have Harris Castro, and then Sanders Buttigieg tied. And then
come on, Kyle.
Sorry.
Airtime
it's got to be Warren.
Okay.
Or Booker. Sorry.
So,
Harris, Castro, Booker, and then Buttigieg and Sanders.
All right. Well,
Harris, Castro, Booker, Buttigieg, Sanders.
All right.
Something like that.
I just disagree on Castro, but that's it. And you know, I think that's not bad.
He'll have his moment. I surprised myself with that, but you know, we're paying attention.
All right, that's our debate analysis for last week. I'd like to know what other people think as well. You can write to us otw@2600.com. Oh, it's our film. See, I promised we'd have a theme, and we do. It's our film. Analysis for what we saw in the last week. We're going through all the Academy Award winning films from the beginning, and we're up to 1950, actually 1950 and 1951. We saw All About Eve, and that was from 1950, the Academy Award winning picture. What a picture that was. What do you think, Kyle? Do you like that one?
I like it. You know, it was interesting. It was a good story.
Wasn't a lot of action.
It was a lot of dialogue, a couple different scenes. I'm thinking of the international film we watched too, so I'm trying to separate the two. But the sort of theatrical Broadway themes, a lot of dressing rooms and hotel rooms, and but I think the universality of that story. I think it's great to have told it in this medium because mm-hmm. it's about stardom and celebrity in a lot of ways, and just. It was a great treatment and interesting.
It's basically about this star, played by Bette Davis. Her name is Margot Channing. And she has, I guess, what you would refer to as a stalker, who her name is Eve Harrington, all about Eve, played by Ann Baxter. She basically camps outside a play that Bette Davis is starring in night after night, eventually gets to meet her, and slowly takes over her life, starts working for her, and then becomes her stand-in, and then replaces her, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot more to it than that. There's so much witty dialogue, so much as far as plot development, and just really clever back and forth at parties and performances and things like that. Kind of surprising for 1950. You expect it to be a bit more stodgy, but it was a pretty lively film, I thought it was really good as far as just something that made you think. I'm not a big fan of action. I'm not a big fan of chases and things like that. And you certainly didn't have that in this film.
Chases?
Car chases or horse chases or things like that. There was none of that. You just had a lot of, back in the mind games, that kind of thing. It was scary. It was scary. The character of Eve scared me because she was plotting. She wasn't what she seemed. She seemed to be this innocent girl who had come in from San Francisco, and of course she had never even been to San Francisco, and was a big fan of this person, but in actuality she just had her sights on her so she could become her. And you see the ways that she was doing that over the course of the film.
What did you think about the narration?
That's right. It was presented in an interesting way. It starts at an award ceremony, and then they do a freeze frame, and then there are various characters that narrate what happened before that,
throughout
6 months.
Yeah, the flashback.
Flashbacks. And that was cool because that was a fairly new technique at the time.
Right. Then they return to it.
They return to it. You go through this whole film, and then you're back at the award ceremony after you've learned all this. And you see the reactions when Eve is getting this award. You see how certain people aren't clapping, and you're wondering, why aren't they clapping? Well, after you see the film, you know why they're not clapping. And it adds so much to it. In fact, I want to see the intro again where the main narrator kind of describing the whole scenario. The guy, Addison DeWitt, he's the
writer.
The writer.
Film critic,
yeah. He's very important in this world. But the things he says are quite meaningful, and obviously he is aware of everything that's going on there. So, yeah, this is really interesting film. I've never seen it before, didn't know the story, didn't really know much about Bette Davis films, but this is one I would definitely recommend. Of course, there's a twist ending where Eve gets her own stalker at the end, so you just kind of see, in a way it's sort of... It sort of tells a story about how stars are really afraid of their fans, and that it could be seen as kind of a put-down.
Yeah, it had a bit of Twilight Zone feel. I mean, obviously a lot of the stories from television and that show in particular were beginning and airing around then or soon to air. So this had that very mysterious thing, and most of that was... The actors themselves portraying in such subtle ways mm-hmm. this plotting innocence, as you said, and little things like that, and of course the gender roles and some of the other more subtle themes. Homophobia is written about a lot in how she becomes her helper and partner almost as almost as though she is a domestic companion and, mm-hmm. and so on. And so there's some of that also all occurring within the production code era where none of the sex or any of the, you know, any kind of it is allowed. So, and it has been thought of as something with these undertones, but then also is looked at and lauded, I think, by the gay community as kind of getting at a lot of the sort of social norms of the era. And, of course, Bette Davis having a lot of the fan base and her previous work.
I have some problems with the plot. For instance, I don't get why Eve wouldn't know the name of the theater in San Francisco that the play was at. She got that wrong, and that's how Addison DeWitt figured out that she was a liar.
The Schubert.
Yeah, there's no Schubert Theater in San Francisco.
Everybody knows that.
Everybody knows that. I don't get why she secretly became Margot's understudy. You know, she said don't tell her, or she made sure that she wasn't told. Obviously, that's not going to land well when she finds out. So I think she could have played that a little bit better.
Secretly replaced an understudy. There was already an understudy.
There was an understudy,
it's
right.
Crazy. It's like a second understudy. And I don't know.
Yeah, something happened to the first one. But
if you've been performing, like I've done a little bit of theater and like dance and stuff like that, and you do. I mean, an understudy is a pretty general thing to have. If an actor gets sick or if a dancer injures themselves, you got to have somebody that can step in. If you have 90 shows to do for 2 months, or you know 100 shows, you don't want to have gaps in those performances. You've sold all those nights,
right?
And that's keeping the lights on. You know, so I can empathize, and that's a total. Standard practice, but in the context of this, it's even more fascinating. She's usurping particular understudies to take on the guys and really own this role she's trying to slip into, this life role, this profession almost. And then I think that the real Twilight Zone thing comes back around when that surprise twist ending with an understudy of her own, Phoebe.
Well, not an understudy yet. Just an obsessed fan that broke into her apartment.
In the exact same way. That reciprocal or perpetual celebrity, the desire for celebrity, and then the churn of actors and actresses and career trajectories and how it's viewed in that industry. It just really... for how long ago it was, it's so self-aware and self-referential to that that burgeoning and so popular an industry that, you know, so many people are getting turned on to. We have radio stars, but here we are with the visual medium and the intersecting of theatrical and picture performers. It was this thing that perhaps a lot of people realized, but was unspoken. It was just not addressed until this story gets sold, and that it's based on a performer's particular experience and the writing before that. It fits. You have a good story, you tell it in a good way with actors and actresses that are really really molding the characters in an authentic way. You just have this powerful story that, as I said, is almost mysterious and other world, you know, kind of a thriller like Twilight Zone.
Yes. Well, that was our 1950 film from the United States, All About Eve. We moved on to 1951. We haven't seen the United States film yet, but we have seen the foreign film. It was from Japan. Okay, you laugh like that because all the characters in that film laugh like that. I don't know why. Oh, my God. It was driving me crazy. It's called Rashomon. The reason this music is playing, what does it sound like to you? To me, it sounds a hell of a lot like Ravel's Bolero. You know what Ravel's Bolero is. I don't have to play that. I mean, you would know it if you heard it. You can't possibly do it at the same time as playing. But this is the music that was playing in that film, which is so derivative of that.
It's like stock music, you know, like...
And you hear it, right?
It's not Billy Joel, it's like Willie Soul or something, you know, it's like the store brand.
Yeah, well, anyway,
generic.
There's that, okay? But this was basically a film that, well, it's generally seen to be one of the greatest films ever made. I don't quite get that. Maybe because of all the laughing, maybe because the story that they tell many different times from different perspectives. And to me, it's pretty similar, all the people's perspectives, including the ghost of somebody who was killed in the story. It's just a question of, okay, who actually plunged the dagger in at the end? And you find you're not really caring all that much. It was an interesting study, I'll say that, of 12th century Japan, if that's your thing. You know, where basically a husband and wife are attacked, and the wife is raped, and the husband rejects the wife because now she's been with another man. You know, nonsense like that. Having that hammered into your head over and over again, while there's a rainstorm going on and these people are telling the story over and over again, it was different. It wasn't Hollywood, I'll say that. I don't know. I didn't see it as riveting as a lot of critics are saying.
I'm with you. I was not as enthralled. And I think there's undertones, there's subtleties of the character development that were maybe missed.
Uh-huh.
Or our viewing of it, we were just, for the first time, and maybe not hearing some of the depth there. Or maybe there just wasn't depth on a lot of what they were trying to convey. But I was not drawn into it. And yeah, the constant laughing and shrieking and... I had a baby crying at one point. It's like every annoying thing that bothers you on an airplane made into a movie. I don't know.
Wow, you're right.
It was just annoying.
Well, except for a Japanese guy laughing loud and long. I don't get that on airplanes.
Well, whatever.
Very much,
people laugh obnoxiously on all kinds of forms of transportation. That's not the point. It just had every... the only parts of it there were annoying things. And the cinematography was okay, but...
The cinematography was really good. I have to give that, especially compared to All About Eve, which was not known for his cinematography, because Joe Mankiewicz was a very dialogue-driven director. So it was basically about, okay, let's capture the conversation. This was more artistic.
Yeah.
They had all kinds of... Filming the sun. I don't think any film had ever filmed the sun directly before. Or handheld camera. Following people through the woods. That was unique. And using flashbacks. My God, did they use flashbacks in this film. That was new at the time, too, 1951. So, yeah, you know, artistically, I think it was better. But plot-wise, kind of dragged for me.
Yeah, the characters need to drive that. And mm-hmm. It just... I feel like I was missing something in what they were saying. I mean, of course, we're reading subtitles.
Well, yeah.
It is in Japanese, so okay. Aha, that may be why, Kyle. But no,
I don't know if it would have helped that much.
I don't know. Maybe being a have it being the first language and not having to read it yourself, maybe I would have picked up more in the dialogue. I would have been more really wrapped into the story. But that shouldn't make a difference. It shouldn't be the determining factor. So it was interesting. But even cinematography, you mentioned those things. Nothing's really leaping out at me. I would probably recognize interesting costumes and the swords. The sword play was probably more noteworthy.
A lot of sword play.
I don't know.
Yeah. I've had it with sword play. Just way too much of it.
Yeah, that was overdone, too. Yeah, a lot.
Anyway, that was our 1951 foreign film, Rashomon, and we'll be moving on to our 1951 domestic film, which remains untitled at the moment, but we'll know it pretty soon, and we'll talk about that next time. As we turn the projector off and move on to the rest of the program, you can write to us, otw@2600.com. There was a lot going on this week as far as visiting the camps. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went to some of the, what do you call them, concentration camps, internment camps, prison camps, summer camps?
Detention camp?
Yeah, it's a place where families are kept or children are kept, where families are broken up. It's disgusting. It's something that we're not used to in this country. And, you know, I'm kind of glad that attention is finally being drawn to this.
Let's just be clear, too. This was the first that I think we've heard our representatives have access.
Mm-hmm.
And their recollection of it, I think particularly AOC, was that these people were being told that they could drink toilet water, that kind of crap. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on here that we just have not had access. I think, you know, a lot of the other reports and issues, we've also not been able to get our representatives involved in that. So that this was like a really big deal that these representatives were able to go and visit and able to audit, kind of look at what our tax dollars are paying for there.
Well, a group of lawmakers visited two of the facilities in Clint and El Paso, Texas yesterday, and they shared their information. It was organized by the Congressional Hispanic Caucus after reports about the Clint border facility indicated migrant children were being neglected. According to the Associated Press, children were separated from their families, sat in soiled diapers, ate meals with little nutritional value. And then, this is something else. Yesterday, ProPublica reported on a private Facebook group for current and former Border Patrol agents where they shared derogatory comments about migrants and female lawmakers, including those on the tour. One post suggested a GoFundMe should be made to compensate whoever would hurl a burrito at Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Representative Veronica Escobar of Texas during their visit to the Clinton border facility. Yeah, that's the mentality we're dealing with here. Members also made sexist comments about Ocasio-Cortez sharing photoshopped images of her in sexually explicit situations. Horrible stuff like that. In a news conference after their tour of the facilities, lawmakers tried to share the bleak details of what they saw, although their words were drowned out by protesters calling for more border security and deportations. Many of the protesters used racist and sexist language. Representative Rashida Tlaib of Minnesota, one of the first Muslim women to join Congress, along with Ilhan Omar, had to speak over a protester yelling, "We don't want Muslims here." She said, "You can all scream at me. I will never stop speaking truth to power." Words of a true patriot. In a statement about the investigation into the Facebook group, Customs and Border Protection Chief Carla Provost said these posts are completely inappropriate and contrary to the honor and integrity I see and expect from our agents day in and day out. CPB has initiated an investigation and said any employees who have violated the agency's guidelines will be held accountable. Of course, they're investigating themselves. I'm not sure how much credence we put in that.
Yeah, that's real brave.
Yeah. Now, hats off to Representative Joaquin Castro, different Castro, of Texas. While all the lawmakers were required to hand in their cell phones during the tour.
Yeah, that was another
what
thing.
What the hell? Is this North Korea? I mean,
I was going to mention. No, and that's
he. Yeah, go ahead.
That's deliberately preventing our representatives from documenting what they see there, and that was another attribute.
Well, he was able to use a device to take footage of the facility's crowded cells and showers. So he smuggled a device in. That's what our Congress people have to do, is smuggle devices into facilities in our own country so that people can find out the truth.
It's probably like an Apple Watch or something.
Yeah, well, they'll be looking for that in the future.
I know. Well, hey, keep them on their toes.
But he shared that on Twitter. He described the showers as dank, dirty, and only too small a number for the hundreds of people there just a few weeks ago. Absolutely disgusting, the things that are going on. And to hear how it's defended, you know, is insane. Part of the dialogue I'm seeing now is that, yeah, you were told that this was going to happen, that there were too many people at the border. What do you expect? Well, you know, from the very beginning, people were against this. So to somehow hurl the responsibility onto the people that are objecting about the facilities and have been from the beginning, that is really disgusting and very misleading.
It's deflecting from admitting that you created the circumstances, too.
Uh-huh.
Because nobody that is against and believes these are abhorrent conditions was for this.
Right.
This was a ratcheting up from everything we've seen, mainly to draw attention to this issue so that the president can rant about it at rallies.
Uh-huh.
That's basically what's going on. This isn't being fixed.
No, definitely not. Now, that Facebook group, I haven't seen the Facebook group. It's a secret group, but it's made up of Customs and Border Patrol officers, both present and past. It's got 9,500 of them. And do you know how many people are agents, officers, right now? I think it's something like 20,000. That would be half. That's like half of them engaging in this horrible, racist, sexist, hateful banter, thinking they're safe. Well, you're not safe anymore because we found out about it, you know? And that's the kind of thing that I think democracy is all about, where, you know, you basically uncover these things. Now, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was tweeting a couple of things yesterday. She said, these CBP officers saying they felt threatened by me, because that's what they were saying. Yeah, they felt threatened by her. They were literally discussing making a GoFundMe for an officer who attacked me on my tour. They confiscated my phone. They were all armed. I'm 5'4". They're just upset I exposed their inhumane behavior. You know, no matter whether or not you agree with what she says, that kind of behavior, that kind of standing up for what you believe in, that is courageous. And you have to acknowledge that. It just, there's simply no way to see it differently, as far as I can see. Anyway, Congresswoman Madeline Dean, she said, just left the first CBP facility. The conditions are far worse than we ever could have imagined. 15 women in their 50s and 60s sleeping in a small concrete cell, no running water, weeks without showers, all of them separated from their families. This is a human rights crisis. And keep in mind, folks, these are not people charged with a crime. These are people that are trying to get asylum into our country. God knows why, but they believe this country is a better place for them. And if they're willing to go through all of that to become a citizen of this country, I think they should become citizens tomorrow or today, because they will be damn good citizens. They've done so much more to earn that citizenship than any of us have. It's just disgusting the way they are being treated. And we've done something to help a little bit. We've compiled a list based on things that have been given to us and information that we've investigated. Concentrationcamps.us is a full listing of all the Customs and Border Patrol facilities that are out there. Now, not all of them are camps, but they all are addresses controlled by Customs and Border Protection. And if there is a camp run by them, it would be at one of those addresses, and certainly the people at those addresses will know about the camps that are local to them. There are more. There are some private facilities. There are some on military facilities. There are some in immigration and ICE-controlled, we are going to continue to build that list up. But it's getting a lot of attention today, I'll say that. We just introduced it.
If you want to add addresses and locations that you think are good candidates to be a part of this list, please send your contributions and comments to otw@2600.com. And we will consider that information to be a part of this compilation. But I think it's an outstanding effort, and I think a great resource.
So much more we could say about this, but we are out of time, unfortunately. So please write to us, as Kyle said, otw@2600.com. Stay tuned for Finn. And here's a tribute to the Women's World Cup team everywhere, all the teams, and how they are playing a cleaner game. And maybe these are the people that can rescue football from its negative impressions that have been instilled over the years. We'll see you next week. Good night. I hit the wrong button, I'm sorry. Give me one second here. Hit the right button, and good night.
I throw half bricks for the Arsenal. I chuck red butt for West Ham.
I kick a man for Chelsea.
I kill for Tottenham.
I drop bottles for United on the crowd from up above.
Yes, football is a game that we all love.
I raise a slash for Sheffield.
I cut them up for QPR.
I stick nails in them for Norwich.
For Leeds, I slash and scar.
For Celtic, I throw petrol bombs whenever a team score.
Yes, football is the game that we adore. We all love football.
Kill.
Right.
Slash.
Ah.
We all love football.
Shoot.
Stab.
Boot.
Ah.
Football is the game that we adore.
I hack limbs off for Newcastle. I rake for Luton Town.
For the Rangers, I kill strangers and kick these horses down.
I set fire to referees who let opponents score.
Yes, football is the game that we adore. We all love football.
Bomb.
Hurt. Kill.
Ah.
We all love football.
Slash.
Kick.
Maim.
Oh.
Football is the game that we adore.
weekend.